Would he accept it? Fingers crossed. After a moment's hesitation, Droy took the axe from me and began studying the handle. Yes! He did it! Shaking with triumph, I hurried to open Droy's stats. Oh, wow. He'd received more or less the same penalties as I had. But that was irrelevant. I'd just managed to prove that the Chaldeans weren't tied to their own weapon types. How cool was that? It opened up some truly promising horizons. The axe was already changing hands. The Chaldeans were busy discussing it as they studied it closely, looking for some signs known only to them. I leaned back, staring at the fire, and trying to calculate how much my future rearmament race might ultimately cost me. Chapter 3. Early the next morning, we grabbed a quick bite to eat and set off for the upper city, as I'd christened it. We'd broken camp, planning to set up anew on the mountaintop, the tribe's future home. To show some team spirit, I chose to walk on my own 2 feet, especially seeing as the 2 wounded raid members couldn't walk at all. They were dragged along in makeshift sledges that Krim had fashioned the night before. I was helping Ormond to drag Horm, while Droy and Krim took turns pulling Seat along. Judging by their stats, the wounded guys were about to come round. With all its fabled authenticity, Mirror World was still a computer game. The sledges slid effortlessly over the snow, allowing us to reach the summit before midday. We had to thread our way around many a collapsed building, which was actually for the better. This didn't make it any easier for any potential enemy. Actually, I needed to check the hunters' stats to see whether they could make traps and snares. If they could, then this trek was begging to be turned into a deadly gauntlet for any trespassers. The Chaldeans loved the spot. They even began discussing how they were going to set up tents and things. Yeah, dream on, guys. I had my own ideas regarding our future camp's planning. Some of them might not like it, but one thing was for sure. I wasn't going to tolerate the chaotic mess that passed for a Chaldean camp. Ormond started the fire. We were already making ourselves comfortable around it, about to discuss everything we'd seen, when a strange noise alerted us. The Chaldeans froze momentarily, then leapt to their feet and ran toward the wall, which offered a good view of the valley. While I was getting my act together, the sound repeated again and again, louder and stronger every time, until finally I realized what it was I was hearing. It was a Chaldean bugle. The snowstorm had stopped already an hour ago. The valley lay before us in a dull, cloudy half-light, revealing the black dots of our fellow tribesmen on the white snow below. Something wasn't right there. Definitely. But of course. How stupid of me. This was the rest of the tribe approaching. And if they signaled with their bugle, it meant they were in trouble. Our clan was under attack. I had to act fast before my team awoke from their stupor and did something they would later regret. "Droy," I said, investing as much authority in my voice as I could muster. The Chaldean leader startled and looked at me. "Wait for me here," I said. "Do you hear me? You can't do anything there. At least the enemy can't get here. The ancient magic of this place won't let them in." After last night's battle, I'd already explained to them this place was actually a mixed blessing. Make sure the guys keep their emotions in check. They're not in a position to help the tribe. If they try, they'll only get themselves killed. I'm gonna fly there. My little mechanical friends will be of more use there. You know that yourself. Droy's gaze cleared. He must have remembered my scarabs and their defeat of the Noctians.
Go,
he wheezed. Good. Droy seemed to take it seriously. Now I could leave them. I could only imagine what it was going to cost him. His own son was with the tribe, as well as the other guys' families. The moment Boris appeared, I sprang into the saddle. With a sharp jolt, we were already airborne. The air screamed in my ears. My eyes were running. Sensing my state of mind, Boris was doing his best. We crossed the valley as if it wasn't even there. As we approached, I could see the tribesmen waving their hands to me. The carts and sledges, the animal noises, the shouting of the children and women. The bugle sang its melody again. What a powerful instrument. I was already flying above the traveling group when I finally understood the reason for their anxiety. They were surrounded by Noctians on three sides, who drove them like a herd of bison from a safe distance of about 200 paces. They probably didn't dare come any closer for fear of Chaldean arrows. How many of them were there? At least 300. They walked unhurriedly. Their ugly faces betrayed no sign of fatigue. The Chaldeans, however, looked exhausted. Their numbers seemed to have gone down. I ran a quick check. I was right. Damn it! The system showered me with warnings and alerts. The Chaldeans were at the end of their tether. Most of their stats had dropped at least 40%. We were 260 now. Minus 26 clan members. Damn those Noctians! Why weren't they attacking? I double-checked their positioning. Aha. From what I could see, the Noctians seemed to be thinking they were herding their quarry to the slaughter. They were sure that the Chaldeans wouldn't dare enter the Forbidden City, so they'd be forced to stop and fight. The cannibals' ugly mugs betrayed their impatience. This group didn't seem to have anything in common with the Noctians killed by the city's ancient guards. One of them stood out, even among his hairy tribesmen. He towered at least two heads above the rest, his body covered in shaggy, dark fur, which looked almost black. Definitely the leader of the pack, judging by how the others were running around him. A werewolf, for sure. A group of about 50 more Noctians, armed with stone axes, surrounded him as some prehistoric analog of bodyguards. I flew up closer. Shaggy had noticed me a long time ago, and was looking at me with curiosity now. Our eyes met. So, this one seemed to be marginally smarter than the rest. His black eyes glinted with all the superiority of a wild beast, and maybe just a tad of discomfort. Normal, really. A midget flying a magic animal can discomfort anyone. Boris banked into a steep turn, heading back toward the Chaldean group. I made out Laosh's gaunt frame at the center of their ranks. He was looking up, waving his hand to me. Soon, I was already standing before him. The old man was in a bad way, his eyes red from lack of sleep. Apparently, the Noctians prevented their prisoners from stopping for the night. The Chaldeans' rough voices cheered my arrival. Laosh gave me an unembarrassed hug. Hands kept slapping my back and shoulders. "You've made it," I said, when they finally left me alone.
"Not all of us, unfortunately,"
the shaman replied.
"Still, we're here. And you?"
"We're fine," I reassured him. "The city belongs to us." "What about those?" I nodded at the Noctians.
"They attacked us in the dead of night," Laosh replied curtly. "We lost almost 30 warriors in that battle. It's been 3 days they've been following us."
I clenched my teeth to suppress my anger. "They're driving you like game beaters. Never mind. As long as we make it to the city, they'll never get you." Laosh's eyes focused watchfully on me.
"I can sense some powerful witchcraft."
I produced the sphere from my bag by way of answer. Laosh closed his eyes.
2 weeks' protection,"
he whispered with relief. I climbed back into the saddle. "Laosh!" I turned to the shaman as Boris took off. "I'll try and buy you some time, but be quick!" The old man nodded and began barking orders. As Boris headed toward the Noctian ranks, I noticed a few smiles on the Chaldeans' faces. I checked their stats. Indeed, their morale numbers seemed to have improved ever so slightly. And what if... "Would you like to activate the Hand of the Outcast?" "Absolutely." "Congratulations! You've received +30 points to all your clan members' morale. Duration, 5 hours. By now, the entire tribe had already heard the good news. The Forbidden City was safe and off-limits for Noctians. That, in combination with the Hand of the Outcast, had produced the desired effect. The Chaldeans picked up the pace. Even the women and children fell quiet. Men strengthened their grips on their weapons, their faces glowing with determination. Even the animals seemed to realize the importance of the moment. I seemed to be feeling different, too. How weird. My emotions seemed to have intensified, my blood boiling with adrenaline. What's that? Had the VR capsule staff injected my lifeless frame with amphetamines after I'd activated the Hand of the Outcast? I absolutely needed to find that out once I resurfaced back in the real world. The change in their quarry's mood hadn't gone completely unnoticed by the Noctians. They grew restless. Their leader emitted a powerful growl encouraging the others. "Bad timing, dammit. That bastard was too smart for his own good. Never mind. We'd give him something to do in a minute." Actually, easier said than done. What was I supposed to do? Step in their horde's way with my insect squad? But this wasn't a couple dozen werewolves. These guys would just trample right over us. End of story. I'd waste the remaining metal in vain. Still, I had to put my money where my mouth was. Especially because I already had the first inklings of a very simple plan. I decided to attack Shaggy, the leader. Why not? I would fly over to him and set a few fleas on him. How about that? Maybe loose a few slugs from my slingshot just to keep him on his toes. He's not gonna like it. And when the others see their leader's humiliation, they'd be reluctant to continue their pursuit. That settled then. The Noctian leader was already directly below me. He scowled. Level 350. Not too shabby at all. The other Noctians bared their teeth at me. I was at least 50 feet above them, and still they jumped high in the air, trying to get to me. Those creatures could jump, that's for sure. Shaggy abstained from their impromptu pogo-jumping competition. He could see he wouldn't make it, so what was the point in looking stupid in his own warrior's eyes? I kept a watchful eye on my clan. They were making good speed. I'd managed to distract the Noctians. They were too busy now trying to catch me. I met Shaggy's eye. What a bastard. He too could see the Chaldeans escape, so he promptly switched his priorities, losing all interest in me. The leader emitted a threatening roar. The gray, hairy mass of Noctians shifted as one man, about to follow their fleeing quarry. That made sense. I hadn't aggroed them, had I? Never mind. I'd do it. Now. You've built the simplest mechanical creature, a swarm of fleas. Level 120. Number of swarm members, 5. The first swarm came as a complete surprise to Shaggy. They even managed to bite him at least once each before being struck by his bodyguard's stone axes. Shaggy howled in pain. The Noctians froze, then hurried to his rescue. All hell broke loose. All of them were jumping, trying to get to me and Boris. While they were thus engaged in this admittedly useless exercise, the venom of Swamp Monk began to work, sending Shaggy shrieking to the ground. Then, a strange thing happened. A giant gray Noctian slid like a shadow out of the crowd and went growling for their leader. Soon, the two Noctians were at each other's throats. Oh, wow. It looks like we've triggered a local power struggle, I whispered, watching this battle of the Titans. Soon, the two Noctians transformed to their werewolf shapes. Now they were twice their original size. The venom couldn't kill the leader, whose level and regeneration were now considerably higher. It looked like his opponent realized it, too. Shifty-eyed, he lowered his ears, apparently regretting his impulse, but not enough to surrender. I could see he'd decided to fight to the last. Even if he'd wanted to escape, he couldn't. The Noctians surrounded the two fighters, encouraging them in this prehistoric version of gladiatorial fights. They were too busy now to worry about us. The leader's gray opponent couldn't have chosen a better moment to claim power. Unfortunately, he was no match for Shaggy, who was 10 levels above him. Still, that wasn't my problem. As long as he managed to distract the leader for a while, that was fine with me. Should I send in a few more fleas? Pointless, really. Everything was working out just fine without me. The two were ripping each other apart. The Chaldeans had crossed the valley remarkably quickly. Their first sledges reached the town walls just as Shaggy finally dealt the decisive blow to his opponent. He tilted his head up to the skies and howled, informing the world of his victory. His hapless rival lay at his feet with his throat ripped out. Shaggy gave his tribe a long, almost insane look, as if challenging the next contender to come forth. Predictably, there were none. Heads lowered in a mass act of subordination. Wheezing, the leader turned the still warm body on its back, then ripped his heart out in one strong, practiced motion. Yuck. Blood and gore had never been my thing. Time for me to go. Especially as most of the Chaldeans had already entered the city. As Boris whisked me away, I sensed a hateful glare focused on my back. I turned round. Shaggy watched me leave, munching on his rival's twitching heart. Oh, it looked like the Noctians were here to stay. Chapter 4. I cast a practiced glance at the clock in the upper right corner of my interface. 2 a.m. How funny. I seem to be developing new habits, reflexes even. If you had to check both the time and your own stats 30 times a day, that could be quite habit-forming. In real life, too, I seem to be constantly searching for those pale blue buttons hindering my view. This was actually one of the giveaway signs that you were speaking to a gamer. The person's eyes would constantly wander as they habitually checked his or her stats. The camp was asleep. All but the guards on duty, of course. I'd just finished talking to Laosh. First, I'd had to tell him all about our travels, then listen to his tale of their own trials and tribulations. It had taken me a lot of effort to talk him into getting some sleep. The old man's eyes had glistened with boyish curiosity. He wanted to know everything. He made me recount my conversation with the city keepers word by word. He studied the bunch of keys the ancient masters had given me. He'd reread the scroll several times and inspected the magic sphere, leaving his greasy fingerprints all over its surface. How I understood him. He was now standing in the sacred and terrible place his own parents used to scare him with when he was little. No wonder he was all shaking. Admittedly, the Chaldeans were a highly adaptable bunch. At first, they too had appeared wary, scared even. But soon, they thawed out. They got busy making fires, cooking food, and setting up camp, which must have distracted them somewhat. Also, the rapid succession of several stressful situations must have played their part. After the hasty exodus across the Snowdian Valley, followed by the Noctian attack, and their close escape to the Forbidden City, the Chaldeans felt like little could surprise them. They were safe now, and that was the most important thing. The Noctians hadn't followed us into the city after all. They stopped by the walls, venting their disappointment with some theatrical howling and growling, then turned back toward the hills. Still, I didn't think they were gone for good. Judging by the meaningful stare their shaggy leader had given me, we would hear from them pretty soon. I didn't mind. Why not? With one correction. Our next meeting was to be on my own terms. If the truth were known, I hadn't been at all sure whether the magic sphere would work. It had, which was good news. What a shame we didn't have enough time to prepare properly. As it was, time kept slipping through my fingers like the desert sand. The crackling of wood in the fire felt soothing, while also putting me in a working mode. I opened my control panel. Now that everybody was present and correct, I had full information about my new clan members. Let's start with the worst. Casualties. 6 warriors and 20 civilians. And I had barely begun my leadership. Then again, had it not been for me, the clan might have already ceased to exist. The route chosen by Laosh was fatal. They would have all been killed, either by mobs or by players. In this respect, my conscience was clear. And still I felt uncomfortable. The next bit of bad news. We were running out of food. Another week like this, and they might need to start slaughtering their livestock, which I absolutely didn't want to happen. They had several dozen draft animals, level 300 plus, not counting the young, the sheep, the poultry. I had a whole animal farm under my control. No idea how long my reputation superiority might last, but the opening opportunities were impressive. If you took all the draft animals, plus the carts and the drivers, it was a ready-made caravanning business. Why not? It was an option, surely. We could very easily compete with the Guiding Eyes. I could almost see a banner announcing, "Olgerd and Company, Shipping and Logistics Services, your partner in no man's lands." How awesome was that? I could lay a mean route through this part of the world. And as for the guards defending the convoys, a few dozen level 300-plus NPCs were a force to be reckoned with. Of course, if I failed to find the Twilight Obelisk, I could always take my tribe somewhere else. Not that I was going to give up, but if all my attempts to locate it failed, I wasn't going to make my clan confront a predictably overpowering enemy. Talking about confrontation, today had been a moment of truth for me as well. Finally, I'd realized I could do more than just dance to somebody else's tune. I knew, of course, that the Reflex Bank had been instrumental in my victory, but then again, they wouldn't have achieved much without me either. And if I remembered rightly what Vicky had said, they'd had a lot of guys like myself in the past, but I seemed to have been the only one who'd had something to show for it. In this, too, preserving the Red Owl's clan was my priority. They were my trump card. And as for the city, well, if it didn't work out, we could always find some other place to live. There was plenty of space in No Man's Lands for everyone. Admittedly, the ancient Ennin city seemed perfect for our development. I had a funny feeling these ruins would be full of surprises. Or at least, I hoped they were. The more I looked into clan control, the better I realized that caravanning wasn't the only option open to us. I had almost 300 NPCs at my disposal, warriors as well as regular workers. Their system and interface differed dramatically from those of the players, but it didn't change much, did it? Now, the basics. We didn't have a single green item in the clan. Zilch. Nada. All their tools, weapons, clothes, food, even animals, were gray, albeit high level. That gave me the impression that the Red Owls were literally one step away from a major development breakthrough. Take their blacksmiths, for instance. They only had two. The red-haired Zachary, with giant fists, and Prochorus, a sinewy guy with an ugly scar across his face. They had an apprentice each. That was the extent of it. All the other blacksmiths had died, some on their way, others by the River Quiet. Some had been killed defending their tribal lands. So these two and their assistants were busy working 24/7 trying to meet all of the clan's needs. Each of them had a mobile smithy and some tools, all of them low-quality gray. They were quite efficient, though. The items they made may have been simple, but were sturdy and reliable. Nails, needles, horseshoes, arrowheads, knives, etc., etc. but that wasn't the point. The thing was, I noticed that NPCs didn't seem to have the same professional ranking system as players did. There was no such thing as a master or expert NPC. They only had a skill bar, or rather several, each for every skill. If you looked at them, you'd see that Zachary excelled at weapon making, while Prochorus was good at forging agricultural tools. I needed to look into it further. The camp was asleep anyway. According to Laosh, as long as we had the sphere, we were safe. Apparently even wild animals were supposed to give us a wide berth. Still, Droy, being Droy, had set up patrols on the city walls, as in, better safe than sorry, which was a good thing. Now, the blacksmiths. The first thing I'd noticed was that the quality of their work didn't improve one iota. It seemed permafrozen. I knew why, too. The blueprints were the problem. Each blacksmith had an impressive list of the blueprints he'd studied. All of them were gray, too. Ditto for the materials they used. Iron ore, charcoal, etc. What did that mean? It meant that just bringing them a green, blue, or purple material wasn't enough. The two blacksmiths would then have to study the relevant recipes they could apply to the new materials. In any case, it was worth a try. I'd have to do it first thing tomorrow morning. As for the levels of the resulting items, they depended on the blacksmith's own level. Prochorus was level 270, and Zachary 290. That's if I understood correctly. Both were also decent lancers. Not as good as Droy and his gang, but if they wanted to abandon their tools and become warriors, they could easily do so. The NPC class and profession system seemed to be much more supple than that of players, probably because they didn't have to pay for their account upgrades. Prochorus, the one who made agricultural tools, was actually a red owl himself, while Zachary was an ex-black axe. Which offered another very interesting insight. The black axes were mountain dwellers, good at everything to do with mining or masonry. In view of the upcoming events, those skills would be a godsend. The red owls, in turn, specialized in livestock farming and agriculture. Perfect symbiosis. The six military engineers mentioned by the game engine especially interested me. I was already dreaming of all the things we could do together. No such luck. By military engineers, the game meant siege vehicle staff, which was already a good thing, I suppose. We even had our own trebuchet now, which was a mixed blessing, really. Firstly, this useful machine had suffered a lot in the last battle. Secondly, it required not 6, but 10 men to operate it. And thirdly, judging by the materials it was made of, I shouldn't hold my breath. But even that wasn't so important. The main thing was, we had a powerful weapon, which just might become a weighty argument in any future confrontations. Apart from these professions, we also had a master crossbow maker and a master fletcher. Plus, a guy who made nothing but arrows and crossbow bolts. Plus, 2 female healers. Not that it was a lot. The kids didn't boast any particular skills. They were mainly gatherers who could be used to run errands, I suppose. I didn't bother to study the tribe's young. All their skills were still in the bud. The kids had a lot to grow and learn. I checked out a couple of the older ones, then closed the tab. I wish I hadn't. Early at dawn, the camp awoke to a new, busy day. The air rang with shouting, singing, and laughter. It was amazing how little time it had taken the Chaldeans to recover from the shock, which was excellent. I checked the control panel. It seemed to function like clockwork. The best thing was, the system was perfectly autonomous. I didn't even need to interfere. Leosh and Droy were more than capable of any decision-making. Remembering Leosh's clingy nature, I hurried to blend into the crowd. I already had a plan of action. First thing, I visited the engineers.
Finally!
Freitas met me by the entrance to his tent.
Please, come in!
His intelligent, pale blue eyes studied me curiously from behind his pince-nez. His short red beard was peppered with gray. An old burn scar marred his large forehead. So I'd been right that night by the fire. Freitas was an intellectual, a fellow nerd. "Thank you, Master Freitas," I smiled back. "How could I have forgotten about you? It's not in my nature to ignore fellow clan members who are worth an entire army." Freitas suppressed a smile. Strangely enough, he felt flattered by my clumsy praise.
"Please, take a seat. Would you like some herbal tea?"
Yes, please, I said absent-mindedly as I sat down at the table, trying to take in my surroundings. No wonder. The engineer's humble tent looked more like an antique design office. It was busy with piled-up books and scrolls, plank tripods holding makeshift drawing boards, and all kinds of rulers, compasses, quills, inkwells, and tons of other items whose purpose I could only guess. Freitas noticed my interest.
"We are settling down, bit by bit."
He made a sweeping gesture around the tent.
"Your tea."
A silent pause hung in the air as we savored our hot, perfumed drinks, casting studying glances at each other. Even buffless, the tea still tasted great.
"So,"
Freitas broke the silence first,
"what brought you to my humble abode?"
"Firstly, I wanted to get to know you better," I said, earning an encouraging nod from him. "Secondly, I did mean it when I said that your engineering crew was worth an entire army. Artillery is an important argument in any battle." He looked up at me in surprise.
"How do you know these words? Artillery, engineering crew. Have you heard them before?"
I nodded. "I have. I'll tell you more. I'm an engineer myself, although in a different field." You wouldn't expect me to tell him I didn't know myself which field it was, would you? He seemed to be completely floored by this last revelation. As he was busy picking up his dropped jaw, I decided to capitalize on the effect. "I've come to you in order to find out what you might need in order to fix the trebuchet and get it running." An hour later, I left the engineer's tent, carrying the list of all the materials he needed. As it turned out, he'd already found 4 new assistants for himself to replace those killed. Now he needed to ask the clan leader's permission to recruit them. And seeing as I was the aforementioned clan leader, I'd given him my permission on the spot. Also, I entitled him to use my name whenever he heeded to seek help from any other craftsmen. And once Freitas found out I could get him any materials he could possibly need, he hurried to compile a lengthy list. Once that was out of the way, we'd spent some time talking over tea. The red-bearded engineer told me the sad tale of their failed storming of the citadel, about Laosh's useless command, about the death of his friends, and about the loss of 10 machines out of 11, the last one only salvaged by his colleague's heroic efforts. I ended up soothing him and calming him down. If the blueprints he'd shown me were any indicator, the machine in question did resemble a medieval trebuchet. It seemed to work well, even though, according to Pretus, it could use a few improvements. Despite his gray gear and tools, I could see that this individual was long ready to advance to the next level. And, of all people, I could help him with that. As I walked back, I noticed the orderly layout of all the tents and marquees. Droy must have taken my advice to heart and made sure that the camp didn't resemble an illogical maze anymore. The sounds of hammered steel were coming from Zachary's mobile smithy. I was just about to go and see him when my gaze alighted on one of the carts. How interesting. This was a traditional Kaltean cart, which looked no different from the rest, with one exception. All of its parts were covered in a fancy vine-like pattern. I walked over to it. On closer inspection, the patterns turned out to have been made with ordinary green paint. Still, the artistry of them was incredible. I walked around the cart several times, tracing the vine pattern. The more I looked at it, the more details I noticed. Not a single identical leaf or twig. Each of them seemed to have its own meaning and purpose. This was amazing. Curious, I decided to check the item's stats. Imagine my amazement when I realized that the anonymous artist had considerably improved both the cart's protection and its durability. I opened the clan control panel and looked for the transportation tab, then searched through items by durability. The painted cart was at the top of the list, well ahead of all the others.
"Nice, eh?"
a wheezing old voice asked behind me. I promptly closed the windows and turned round. An old Kaltean stood not 5 paces away from me, his hair snow-white, his broad face furrowed. His bushy white eyebrows stood on end like the wings of a bird. Despite his old age, his shoulders were broad and strong. I hurried to check his stats. Aha! This was Crunch. His most advanced skill was cart maker, with cart driving and draft animal care just behind it. I'd been expecting something like that. I checked the blueprints he'd studied. This was a very, very useful senior citizen. "This is awesome," I agreed, "and the durability it adds." The old man kneaded his beard, then cast me a suspicious look.
"We are talking about the cart, aren't we?"
I smiled amicably. "Not exactly. I was talking about your drawings." He stared at me, uncomprehending. Then it dawned on me. This old NPC couldn't see all the advantages of his own work. How was it possible? Judging by his large, rough hands that resembled 2 digger shovels, how could he have even managed to create something this beautiful? "Haven't you noticed that your cart became sturdier after you decorated it?" I asked him. The cart maker gave his creation another look, as if seeing it for the first time. He crouched and studied the bottom of the cart, then yanked at the wheels.
"I think you're right,"
he finally said.
"I couldn't understand why the shaft had lasted so long. Normally it should have broken several times already, and the wheels are still in one piece. Actually, it's lasted me for ages without a single accident."
He ran his hand lovingly over the painted designs.
"Thanks for telling me what it was, Olgod. I heard people say that you can see things nobody else can. Now I've witnessed that myself."
"Oh, I'd love to know what else they were saying about me. Still, I couldn't wrap my head around the man's behavior. He must have read it in my face, because he dissolved in a smile.
You must be thinking, how's that possible? How come a master can't see the results of his work? Am I right?"
I shrugged. I had nothing to say to that. His next phrase confused me even more.
"I'll tell you something. You're probably right. The master can see the results of his or her work. But I can't."
He smiled dreamily, thinking about something. Oh, great. An NPC with a split personality disorder. "Dear Master Crunch," I said, slowly backing away, "thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed talking to you. Unfortunately, I have too many things to..."
"You wait,"
he said.
"I'm not crazy, if that's what you think. I told you that the master could see the results of her work. I think she did. She did tell me the cart would drive much better."
"Wait a sec," I said. "Now I'm totally confused. Who is she? What's with the master?"
"My granddaughter. My little one. She is the master. She painted the cart for me. And she did tell me it might not need repairs for a while. I didn't believe her, did I? I just let her paint my cart. Why not? There's no harm in that, is there? She's my only flesh and blood. Her parents died 2 winters ago from the sweating sickness. And now this... Oh, no!"
I jumped from his sudden change of temper. The old man grabbed at his head, his eyes wide open.
"She's painted everything we have, hasn't she? The tent, the kitchen pots, even my tools. She wanted to paint my clothes, too, but I didn't let her. Our neighbors were laughing at us as it was. How strange."
Curiouser and curiouser. His oversight was quite understandable, but me? How could I have missed a girl capable of improving items' protection and durability? Very clever, Sir Olgerd. Oh well, I had to correct my mistake now, didn't I? "Dear Master," I said, "you don't need to worry. I suggest we both calm down and talk about it. None of this is your fault."
"No, but..."
I didn't let him finish. "You don't have anything to do with magic, by any chance?" The question completely floored him.
"Oh, me?"
he mouthed, voiceless. "Yes, you."
"I don't think so."
"So you see?" I raised a didactic finger. "If you and your neighbors didn't have an aptitude for magic, how could you have noticed your granddaughter's skills?" He stared at me, uncomprehending. Before he could get his wits together, I continued. You couldn't. Only a shaman or a shaman's apprentice is capable of that. But, as you well understand, they've had their hands full with other things just lately. He nodded.
You could say that.
So you shouldn't worry about it. I suggest we rectify this slight oversight on our part.
Excuse me?
Well, how about we meet your little master for a start?
Yes, yes, of course.
The old man swung around, drawing me along.
Of course, please, come this way.
He was quite fast and agile for his age. As we approached his neat tent, I came across plenty of evidence of the young artist's work. Everything around me was covered in fine, intricately drawn patterns. The fence poles that served as tethering posts for the large, slow buffaloes munching on their grass were decorated all over. Ditto for all the spades and pitchforks, hoes and buckets and clay pots. Each item sported durability and protection bonuses. Cool. I peered closer at the vine-like patterns. They were identical. Even the paint was the same hue of green. Having said that, not really. The girl had also used black and white paints. Three colors. A single pattern, masterfully drawn. What did that mean? It meant that the girl was ready to advance to the next level, but couldn't. She had neither the knowledge nor the right materials. Nor the tools, most likely.
So what did I say?
Crunch made a sweeping gesture around his household.
You can see for yourself, can't you?
You bet, I replied with a smile. I'll tell you more. I like it a lot. Your granddaughter is a very precious asset to the clan. A craftswoman like her should be treasured and cherished. His surprised eyes filled with tears of joy. I could understand him. He'd been living all those years suffering his neighbor's ridicule about the weird child he'd sheltered under his roof. We found the heroine of all the commotion, sleeping soundly inside. Unhesitantly, I opened the girl's stats. Name, Leah. 10 years old. A tiny little thing. A fragile frame, a head of raven-black hair. Her plump little fingers were clutching a thin paintbrush. There was paint all over her face. My heart clenched. She was so like my Krista. Was she okay? A hand touched my shoulder.
Go in,
Crunch whispered.
No point in standing in the doorway.
Sorry. Of course. I shook off the memory and returned to Leah's stats. Skills, a standard set. The girl was a gatherer and a housekeeper. I scrolled through the list. Aha! There it was. Magic painting. The numbers were good. Much better compared to her other skills.
Cheeky devil,
the old man whispered.
Look at my tools. She just couldn't help it, could she?
Indeed, the familiar vine pattern coiled around the wooden handles of his modest tools. This is a very good thing, I told him. Now this hammer, chisel, and saw will last you a lifetime. I suggest you ask her to paint everything else you have in your house. The sooner you do it, the better. What your granddaughter does, she adds magic bind lines to the objects she paints. At the words, magic bind lines, He cast a reverential look at the sleeping girl.
"Why such a rush?"
he asked me.
"Because, dear master," I replied in a whisper, "very soon, Leah might have lots of work to do. With your permission, of course."
Chapter 5. I spent the rest of the day walking around the camp, talking to workers. Blacksmiths, saddlers, shepherds, miners, stonemasons. I hadn't missed anyone. I spoke to each and every one of them, asking questions and listening to their requests. By the time I got back to Droy's tent, I was dead on my feet. I had a splitting headache. Still, the result was worth it. I'd been right all along. The Red Owl's clan was balancing on the edge of a small local revolution. All the Chaldeans needed was a tiny nudge to send them to stage 2 of their social and cultural development. All I had to provide was a scientific base. That is to say, new recipes, new blueprints, and sketch designs for my future masters. Unfortunately, the expensive materials I'd so generously provided them with didn't work at all. You couldn't fool the system. The clan's development had to run its course. What a shame. The heat from the fire felt soothing. The embers crackled, sending sparks into the night sky. A meat stew bubbled in the pot, whetting my appetite. My nostrils welcomed the amazing aromas. Droy grinned at me.
"Tired?"
I sighed. "You can't imagine. Still, it's all gonna work out in the end. You'll see."
"Don't take their complaints too close to heart,"
Droy said, stirring the stew.
"They love moaning. It'll take you an entire lifetime just to look into it all. Have you learned anything about the city?"
I shook my head. "Nothing new. The Black Axes keep rehashing the same old legends, which you already know. Krim is still the only person who's seen the place from afar. All the others are already dead. Some were killed at the Citadel walls, others by the River Quiet."
"It's all right," Droy reassured me. "Tomorrow we'll call up a council. We need to decide how to purge the dungeons you found."
"I'd like to strongly discourage you from that idea," I said. Droy stared at me in surprise, forgetting his stew.
"Pardon me? I thought you guys couldn't wait to go back there. And now you strongly discourage the idea."
I ran a tired hand over my forehead. "I have a funny feeling we might not come out of it alive. It's just a hunch. A foreboding, if you like." How else could I explain it to him? The dungeons were crawling with high-level mobs. How was I supposed to tell him that Chaldean weapons and gear were just not up to the task? He wouldn't understand me. He might even take offense.
"A foreboding? That's serious,"
Droy agreed, returning his attention to the pot.
"You should never disregard a bad foreboding."
"I'm not going to," I said. "We need some time. Once we settle down a bit, then we can start worrying about these things."
"I like your way of thinking."
Droy nodded, bringing a steaming spoon to his mouth. He smacked his lips several times, then paused, apparently thinking what else he could add to his brew. Still, the result seemed to have pleased him.
"Ready."
He lowered the ladle into the steaming, bubbling, thick stew.
"Let's eat."
I offered him my bowl. Life was good. My stomach growled its agreement.
Tim!
Droy called his son.
Come and eat before it gets cold!